Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. We are joined today by Robert J. Mrazek. He graduated from Cornell University, went to the U.S. Navy, served five terms in Congress. I believe it was the 3rd District in New York around Long Island. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. And he is the author of 11 books. And he joins us today to discuss his latest work. The title is The Indomitable Florence Finch, The Untold Story of a War Widow Turned Resistance Fighter and Savior of American POWs. Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Glad to be with you, man.
So when we think about resistance fighters, the classic example from World War II, of course, is the French resistance that we're familiar with. But this is a story from the Philippines. And what I want to do is just ask you to just tell us who Florence Finch was.
Sure. You know, thousands and thousands of books have been written about World War II and about men at war. I've written a couple of them myself, which were, I think, pretty evocative of the time and place. But there aren't a lot of stories written about women during World War II. And Florence Finch was not only a war hero, she was one of the most decorated American women in the Second World War for saving hundreds of American lives, prisoners of war, Americans who had surrendered after the Bataan and Corregidor defeats, after the Bataan Death March. Florence saved hundreds of them. After the war, President Truman gave her the Medal of Freedom, the highest award that a citizen can receive for serving the United States of America. And I think you could ask the question, why don't we know all about Florence Finch? Well, the answer is she never told anybody, including her own children. You know, we live in a time where celebrities are celebrated for becoming celebrities without having achieved anything of substance. And one of the most remarkable things about Florence Finch was she had a deep sense of humility and was always looking forward. And so after the war, she went on with her life. Her first husband had been killed during the Battle of Bataan. He was given by MacArthur the Distinguished Service Cross, which is the second highest award for valor to the Medal of Honor. She remarried for the second time after the war, and 50 years later, 1995, again, her children, now adults, having known nothing about what she had done, the United States Coast Guard contacted Florence and said, we're going to be naming our new Pacific headquarters after you. And her kids, Betty and Bobby, said, you know, Mom, what's going on here? What is involved? They didn't know she'd been married before or what she had done or that she had earned the Medal of Freedom. And it led to her living to the age of 101 in Ithaca, New York, And I learned about the story through reading the obituary, a very long obituary in the New York Times written by Sam Roberts. And the story was just so compelling that thankfully her children gave me the key to the Florence archives. She was a very prolific letter writer. And so I was able to tell the story.
So her story begins in, she's born in 1915 in the Philippines. She is, as you note, a mestizo. Can you explain what that is? And her, she has a rather unique family situation, to put it mildly, right?
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, right out of Charles Dickens, Ian. You know, one of the things when I got started researching the book and I talked to her, you know, adult grown children, and they had plenty of information about everything that Florence endured in her life from the time she was 7 years old and went away to school, never to return home. But she claimed to have no memories of her early childhood. And it wasn't until I was researching legal files in the Philippines that I came upon the legal records of a battle over an estate that was owned by her father. And that is what led to the revelation of what she endured in her early childhood. Her father, Charles Ebersol, volunteered for the United States Army as a kid. He was underage. He was from Buffalo, New York. And he became a medic during the Spanish-American War and the defeat of the insurrectionists in the Philippines after Teddy Roosevelt rode up San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders and the Cuban side of it was over. Spain, of course, had the Philippines as one of their conquests. For 300 years, they administered the Philippines, and then they were defeated by the Americans, and we took over. But after that war ended, Charlie decided he did not want to go back to Buffalo. He was in love with the country. He was very smart, very ambitious. Within a few years, because there were, now it was an American occupation, and American money was going in to build schools and roads and hospitals, and he did a bit of that. But he bought a plantation. It was a very successful plantation, ran almost a mile along the Callao River in Isabela province. And he met a young woman named Maria Hermoso. And Maria was a lovely Philippine woman who was married, unfortunately, from Charlie's perspective, and had a small daughter named Flaviana. Charlie asked her to leave her husband, live with him, although they couldn't be legally married, and she agreed to do that. And they had five children together. Florence was the fourth child. When Florence was 7 years old, Flaviana had grown to be a lovely younger version of her mother, also quite more sophisticated because Charlie believed very much in education, and so she was had learned to read at an early age, and she was a more sophisticated version of her mother and beautiful. She decided to get married, which didn't sit well with Charlie. And a couple of months after their marriage, he rode to their village on horseback, told her, "I want you to live with me as my wife." So this was Florence's stepsister and Charlie's stepdaughter. And so he told Maria, Florence's mother, "You will live in the first little house we had here on the plantation. Well, Flaviana and I are going to live in the big plantation house." And they had a number of children together. And it all blew up when Florence was seven and her mother basically went loco in the local terminology and began beating her children as if they were somehow responsible for the breakup of her relationship with Charlie. And it was at that time that Charlie took aside Florence and her older sister Norma and said, "I'm sending you away to a new school, the Union Church Hall School in Manila, which was created for mestizos, those being half Philippine and half American." And she went to that school at the age of 7 and never went back to the plantation. And she lived there for the next 10 years of her life, being a very becoming a very self-reliant young woman, basically on her own. Her sister, older sister Norma, did not like the school and she left. So Florence was on her own from the age of 7 to 17 at that school, accomplished in every way, number one in her class in all subjects. She also took great pride in mentoring the younger mestizos, who were treated with a good deal of bigotry and pity on the part of the religious people who ran the school, many of whom, you know, looked upon them as tar babies and needed this kind of help. So that's basically how she started in life.
And so she's very bright. She skips a couple of grades, if I recall correctly, and she's very bookish, which is probably unique in the school setting at that time.
Yeah, and she can thank her father for that. He had a library, substantial library at the plantation, and he encouraged his children to read from a very early age, and Florence, being very bright and loved to be carried away in her imagination to different places with the books that she read. So she really had a good head start when she got to the school.
And so eventually she will grow into a young woman and she'll meet a man named Charles Edward Smith, referred to as Bing, B-I-N-G, Bing Smith, and explain how they meet and what happens with them.
Yeah, Charles Smith was an agent for Naval Intelligence in Manila. He was called Bing because he had an uncanny resemblance to the great crooner Bing Crosby. Bing Crosby was a small man. Bing Smith was over 6 feet, very athletic. He was the star pitcher on the Pacific All-Fleet Navy baseball team, larger-than-life personality. And when he first met Florence, she was the de facto manager of the Army-Navy YMCA in Manila, which was a huge organization. We controlled not only the Philippines, but we had the Pacific Fleet all over the Far East. And the Army-Navy YMCA had hundreds of rooms so that Naval and Army officers and men could stay there. And it had, so it was a big operation. And she was the top assistant for the man who ran the Army-Navy YMCA, who was in love with Florence at the time, H.J. Schofield. Anyway, Bing met her. They began going together. She was a much more sheltered person than Bing, who was, again, a guy who had seen it all. I'd been in the Navy for a number of years. And he got her a job working for the deputy head of Army Intelligence, a lieutenant colonel named Carl Engelhart. He was, again, this was the intelligence gathering for the American Army in the Philippines. And Engelhart needed a bright assistant who was willing to work hard. And he hired Florence to be one of his team, intelligence team, there in Manila. And as the war approached, she and Bing got married about 6 months before Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And it became more and more obvious that the Japanese were planning, in addition to their invasion of China, which had taken place 4 years earlier, that they were on the move. And Engelhart, a brilliant intelligence officer, kept sending up intelligence to General MacArthur through his head of intelligence, a colonel named Willoughby, Charles Willoughby, whose real name was Adolf Weidenbach, or his birth name. He loved Mussolini. MacArthur referred to him as his pet fascist. And Engelhart was suggesting that an invasion by the Japanese was imminent. Willoughby refused to believe it. But within 12 hours of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attacked the Philippines, and an invasion force followed there very quickly.
So this is often a part of this entire period of history. It's often in the shadow of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We often think of the attack in Hawaii as a single event, but it's really part of a large coordinated pan-Pacific effort by the Japanese military to essentially knock out all points of resistance in one fell swoop. And so this is going to things are going to happen quickly throughout December. As you note, she's Florence has been working in this Office of Naval Intelligence. She is essentially does she have dual citizenship at this point, or is
Yes, that was one of the gifts bestowed by Charlie. He made sure that his children with Maria received passports and were acknowledged to be American citizens. So she was both an American citizen and a citizen of the Philippines.
And so she is, one of the things that struck me about her character that's obvious from the get-go is that she is very dedicated. In other words, she cares a great deal about what she has promised to do. And when Englehart and Smith, her husband, Bing Smith, her husband, move along with the rest of the American military to the Bataan Peninsula, she is left behind in Manila with whatever cash Smith has, but eventually she's going to have to get a job. And I was struck by her dedication to her prior job when she got the new job. So you might want to explain what her plight is in Manila when she's left behind there.
Yeah, on Christmas Eve, 1941, the Americans were in full retreat down the Bataan Peninsula, and MacArthur ordered that the Bataan Peninsula should still be defended, but that the remaining people on his staff would go to Corregidor. So Englehart, Colonel Englehart, and Bing Smith went to the fortress at Corregidor. And from there, MacArthur directed the defense of the Philippines against the Japanese Army and Air Force. Bataan fell first. The Bataan Peninsula was taken by the Japanese. The Americans still held this island of Corregidor. It was considered a powerful fortress, but the Japanese bombed it into submission. And by that time, Bing had been killed, saving a crewmate on a mission to help relieve the troops on Bataan. Florence did not know he was killed. MacArthur then gave him that citation for the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously. When Singapore fell, Englehart, who was fluent in Japanese because he had been a military attaché in Tokyo for 3 years. And so when the Japanese took Corregidor, they learned that he spoke fluent Japanese, and he was giving tours to high military brass, Japanese brass, of the fortress. And one of them turned out to be a member of the Japanese royal family, a prince. And he was very struck by how fluent Englehart was in Japanese, and at one point pulled him aside and said, "You're going to be a prisoner of war, but is there anything I can do for you?" And Englehart said, "Yes, there is a young widow who doesn't know she's a widow who used to work for me. And I was wondering if you could present her with the citation that her husband earned for saving his crew and being killed." And the Japanese prince agreed to do that. And a few days later, he knocked on the door where Florence was living and showed her the citation. And it was at that point that she learned that she was a widow. And it led to her making a commitment to herself that she would do whatever she could do to help defeat the Japanese occupying authority. She wasn't sure what that would involve, but it was a commitment she made at that time. And shortly thereafter, she learned about a job that was available at the Philippine Liquid Fuel Union. And the Philippine Liquid Fuel Union was the organization that basically dispensed all gasoline, diesel fuel, kerosene, all liquid fuel to the Japanese Army and Navy. And if there was any left over, and there were supplies left over, it was rationed out to Philippine citizens and businesses and so forth. Some months after taking the job, Florence learned about people who were falsifying warehouse receipts and fuel coupons. And it was one of her jobs to fill out these coupons, the official coupons, and warehouse receipts. And by then she had learned that Engelhardt was still alive, living in Cabanatuan at the big prison camp that had tens of thousands of Americans who had survived Corregidor and Bataan. But they were dying by the hundreds every week, 500, 600 a week, starving, without food, without medicine. And there was an underground communication system created, and she was able to get a message to Engelhardt, and he wrote back, "We are desperate for food, we are desperate for medicine." And it was then that Florence concocted her plan to begin transferring fuel by falsifying warehouse receipts and fuel coupons, selling it on the black market, and using the money to send food and medicine into the camp. To save not only Engelhardt, but through Engelhardt, many, many other POWs who were close to death. And that was what she began. And she did for 2.5 years working at the fuel union under 98 Japanese officers, under their noses, and stealing eventually tons of fuel and using it to save America.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so I should note, this is a story about Florence Finch, but in many ways, this is kind of a dual biography of Carl Engelhardt and his experiences as well, because he wrote his own memoir that's to date still unpublished, correct?
Yes, that's correct. He gave the 300-page memoir to Florence shortly before he died.
Yeah, and so
thankfully, without it, I would have had a far less potent story. It was very understated, but he kept a journal and a spiral notebook of the men dying by the hundreds and what occurred in the camp under the Japanese, and of course what Florence did to save so many of them.
So one aspect of this I was struck by was this courier system that's developed to actually get medicine and food into from outside the camp into the camp. Do we have a sense for exactly how this functioned? in terms of how people were able to actually get this? Because it was amazing to me that these guys are able, it saves their lives. And so they obviously are not going to die as quickly as they would have. Many still do die because of the horrible treatment by the Japanese overseers. But nevertheless, these people are saved. It was just amazing to me that they were able to accomplish it under the nose of these prison guards.
Yeah, one of the American prisoners fairly early on was assigned a job where Filipinos driving caribou, which in essentially oxen, would bring the supplies into the Japanese camp at Cabanatuan, and also the food supplies that were eventually brought in to feed the American prisoners. And he was able to bribe the Filipinos who were bringing the oxen to the camp. And they secreted in these carts, in these ox carts, the food and medicine that then was diverted to the Americans. And it worked very well for quite some time. Eventually, they were discovered, and a number of the Americans who were involved with it were put to death by the Japanese. But in the meantime, food and medicine that really allowed them to slow down the number of deaths was coming in on a regular basis, not only through Florence, but through others who were also committed to trying to help the Americans.
Also in the camps, as you note, or as Engelhardt notes, there's a lot of bribery that's going on with the American prisoners bribing guards to get a variety of different privileges or get away with things. And some of this, the ability to engage in the bribery, is part of the money that Florence and others are sending to these prisoners, right?
That's absolutely correct, Ian. And Engelhardt, again, being fluent in Japanese, was able to be the conduit for bribing the Japanese guards and figuring out ways to enable the flow of goods, if you will, into the camp. He was also able to save a number of American lives because the Japanese routinely and capriciously would at times decide to beat a prisoner to death, and Engelhardt again and again was able to intervene and to save a lot of Americans that way.
And so this goes on, this system of falsifying orders for fuel, and then her cohorts. This is really an organized resistance because her cohorts go to different, there's not one disposal or distribution point. There are multiple points around in the area in the Philippines. And so they take this fuel and they sell it on the black market. That's where they get the cash from. And to me, what was one of the amazing aspects of this is she seems to be the real focal point because it's her requisition orders. In other words, she's the one who falsifies the records. And then she has to get back early when those records come in every week to find the ones that she has falsified in order to destroy them so that she can try to keep this system going and not have it recognize that these are false orders.
Exactly right. It was very dangerous. She would have to come in very early on a Monday when these vouchers would come back from the various dispersal points and find the falsified coupons. The reason she needed to do that was otherwise the Japanese immediately would have known that hundreds of gallons of fuel was lost in that period of time. And so she was able to successfully do that for 2.5 years. She ended up also helping the underground and diverting fuel that they picked up using the falsified warehouse receipts for larger quantities of it. And that was utilized for the resistance against the Japanese. There were thousands of Filipinos who were actively involved with the resistance against the occupying authority. But in October of 1944, a courier representing Florence was captured by the Japanese while bringing smuggling food into the camp, and under torture revealed Florence's name as someone who was a leader of the organization, the underground organization. And so she was arrested by the Japanese in Manila and taken to what was called the Airport Studio. It was a former Japanese-owned photographic studio, which had been turned into a jail and torture center by the Kempeitai. The Kempeitai was the Japanese secret police. They had supreme power. They could arrest Japanese army officers. They could arrest anyone. They could torture anyone. They could murder anyone. And they put Florence in a 2x4-foot cell and kept her there while they were torturing her with electronic devices and other methods, beatings and so forth. But she refused to disclose the names of any of the people she was working with. She finally confessed that she was involved, but refused to compromise any of those who were with her in the network.
And so while she is kept at this location and continually, repeatedly interrogated, she is worn down. She's at one point, she's even raped. And she will eventually be transferred to a rural area, another holding area outside of Manila. And that's where she'll spend the rest of the war in the Philippines. And one thing that's really informative about our understanding of her story is you tell it in the larger context of the war for the Philippines. So let's leave her story for a moment and talk about what's been going on with the commanders in terms of MacArthur, the famous story of him having to leave and then his efforts to return. And so if you can kind of set that up for us in terms of what happens to her at the end of the war.
Right. Well, General Douglas MacArthur was the commanding general of the American forces when the Japanese invaded. And it was deeply humiliating to him that his troops were ultimately going to be defeated. And when General Marshall, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, recognized that the Americans were going to be forced to surrender, they did not want MacArthur, a four-star general, to fall into Japanese hands. So they ordered him to leave the Philippines and go to Australia to reorganize for the rest of the war. And MacArthur didn't want to leave, but he did. He had handled the challenge of defending the Philippines very poorly, according to most military historians. It made him even more committed to coming back to the Philippines to relieve them, to free them. And it took from when he left in early 1942 till October of 1944, when Florence was arrested, to launch the invasion of the Philippines in the Battle of Leyte Gulf and to recapture the Philippines. And he wanted to relieve Manila very badly. And so he sent a strike force of the 1st Cavalry Division into Manila and the surrounding area. And shortly before Florence was to be executed, the 1st Cavalry Division entered her political prison where she was being held and saved her life along with the remaining prisoners. At the time, she weighed 77 pounds. She was tall for a Philippine woman. She weighed 120 at the beginning of the war. She was very near death due to starvation, And she was immediately taken to a hospital in Manoa, and they slowly nursed her back to health. But it was a touch and go as to whether she was going to survive.
And so the war, in terms of her captivity, really for her, it kind of ends with this liberation after Leyte Gulf. The war for Engelhardt goes on for quite some time. And he is, as many of the American prisoners in the Philippines were, he is eventually going to be transported. And that it's touch and go for him. He's you get the sense from your recount that he was extremely lucky.
Yeah, of the thousands of men who were transported to Japan and Korea from the Philippines, when the Japanese knew the Philippines would eventually fall, they decided to turn the Americans who were still healthy enough into slave labor, both in mines in Japan and also Korea. Yes, Engelhardt was incredibly lucky because the first ship he was put on was sunk by an American submarine, torpedoed, and he was one of the survivors of that ship. He was put on a second ship. That one was bombed, and hundreds of the prisoners were killed. He survived that. He was put on a third ship and eventually got to Japan and then to Korea, where he survived the rest of the war. But an amazing survival story by Carl Engelhardt, which really matched what Florence endured in her efforts to try to save Engelhardt and so many of his fellow prisoners.
And so what was truly amazing, again, my admiration for her just increased exponentially when eventually she has a aunt, she has relatives who live in Buffalo, New York. So after the war, she could have stayed in the Philippines. She comes to the United States, but that's not the end of the war for her. So explain what she does when she gets back to the U.S.
Yeah, she regained her weight. As I mentioned, she was 77 pounds when she was rescued. She slowly regained her weight. And she was then informed that there was going to be a ship that would carry Americans from the Philippines back to the United States. Now, she had never been to the United States, the land of her father, but she was an American citizen. And her husband was a decorated officer. So she was able to qualify for one of the first ships to go back to the United States. And entirely on her own, she took the ship, landed in San Diego, took a train across the United States. The only relatives she knew of in the United States were her aunt and her aunt's family in Buffalo, which was Charlie Ebersole's family, her father's family. And she got to Buffalo, and she was slowly regaining her strength. And she felt really like a fish out of water because she was reading about what was happening in the Far East with the Battle of Okinawa, and the war was going on. And she had made a commitment, a silent commitment to her dead husband, Bing, that she would be there. She would fight the Japanese as long as she could. And in the United States at that point, they were kind of tired of the war, and Detroit was gearing up for new automobiles and, you know, new lines of automobiles. And she felt that she hadn't really done enough. So she decided to volunteer for the United States Coast Guard. And her family was horrified, shocked, her aunt, Mabel, but she was committed to doing it. And so she went into the United States Coast Guard and went through training. Jack Dempsey was the head of training at her base, the former heavyweight champion of the United States. And it was while she was completing her training in the Coast Guard that the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that ended the war against Japan.
And so she has this incredible story that she really, like many, like we've heard, they're often referred to the greatest generation because of their humility and their reticence to discuss their wartime experience for people that participated in World War II or fought in a variety of different ways. And she's one of these people who just doesn't tell anybody, as you mentioned earlier, for years. So the story really, in some ways, doesn't end there. There's the story of what happens much, much later with her children and how they learn of it. I was really surprised to hear about her illness and how she deals with that. So can you explain that story briefly?
Yeah, when the war with Japan ended, Engelhardt was released from his prison camp in September of 1945, and he began the journey back to the United States. He first went to the Philippines to try to follow up on all of those who he knew had been working with Florence in saving his life and the lives of hundreds of others. And he learned that just about everybody in her network had been killed or died in Japanese hands. All of the people that he had served with in his intelligence group had been killed or died in Japanese hands. He came to the United States, and one of the first things he wanted to do was meet Florence just to reconnect and tell her how grateful he was. And they met in Washington, D.C., when she was so active with the Coast Guard. And he wondered, how did you accomplish this? How did you do it? And it was then that she told Engelhardt how she had been able to divert the tons of fuel from the Japanese to the resistance, on selling it on the black market, everything she had done. And so 2 years later, in 1947, her story was presented to President Truman's commission, and she was awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Truman. At that point, she had met a young man named Bob Finch, who had served with the Third Army under General Patton in Europe. And they fell in love. And she went with Bob Finch to his new job working for Agway, which was a big agricultural supply operation. And one of its points of operation was in Ithaca, New York. So they moved to Ithaca, New York. And that was where Florence spent the next 70 years of her life. She worked for Cornell University as an administrator for Professor George Kahan, who ran the Far East Studies Department at Cornell. She had her two children, Betty and Bobby. Her husband died young in 1968 of a heart attack. By then, she was very active in the First Presbyterian Church in Ithaca. She was elected a deacon of the church, and she took great pride in mentoring younger members of the church, just as she had with younger mestizos back at the Union Church School in Manila when she was a young woman. And she lived a very quiet life until the Coast Guard announced that they were naming their Pacific headquarters after her. And then she became somewhat of a local celebrity. It was hard not to be with everything. When people learned what she had done and read her citation for the Medal of Freedom. But in 2008, she was put into a hospice program with a misdiagnosis that she was going to be dying of a spinal degenerative disease. And she decided not to be a burden on her family. She would just simply stop eating and drinking. And she had contacted her son, Bobby, who was then running the Parks Division in Denver, Colorado, Parks and Recreation. And he flew to Ithaca and he said, "Mom, please don't do this." And she said, I ask your blessing. I feel it's time. I've had a wonderful life, and it's time for me to end my life. And he said, well, if you're going to do that, I'm going to ask if I can videotape you, which he did for the next 3 days, and which was a great source of information for me. But at a certain point, she regained her strength and her desire to live, and it turned out that she was misdiagnosed. So she left the hospice, and she lived until the fall of 2016. Last couple of years in a nursing home here in Ithaca, and right up to the end. And it's funny, not funny, but I met people now who knew Florence in the nursing home, and who said she was the go-to person by the staff when someone had given up on life and was thinking about wanting to end their life or giving up. They would send Florence in to talk to them about cherishing each day and savoring each day and bringing them around. And so she was remarkable right up to the end.
She certainly was. You note that in 1995, the Coast Guard surprises her by naming their Pacific headquarters. This is in Honolulu, Hawaii, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And she's the only woman in Coast Guard history to have received the Asiatic Pacific Campaign Ribbon.
And yeah, that was a ribbon created by General MacArthur. She's one of the most decorated women of American women of the Second World War. Yeah, you know, it's just amazing in this time of celebrating celebrity that she had no interest in it. In her view, with her sense of humility, she felt that everyone that she had worked with in the underground who had been killed by the Japanese or died in their hands, they were the heroes, not her.
So much of the history that we have come to know about World War II is sometimes told through soldiers' memoirs on the ground, battlefield memoirs and recollections and interviews, but also, of course, from the heights of command, with the biographies of MacArthur and Eisenhower and other figures, political decision makers as well. But I must say, you get a sense for the stories of Englehart, the POW, and Florence, that these are one or a couple of many stories that sometimes we will just never know. And thankfully, you've been able to tell this one, but that there are a lot of people who really helped contribute to the way the war turned out. In other words, the ultimate survivors, the efforts of these people who only intermittently and sometimes not at all are recognized by history. And so thank goodness that you've been able to tell this story.
Yeah, old politicians like me have a tendency, I guess, to exaggerate things. But I must tell you that I've written two World War II nonfiction books, one about Torpedo Squadron 8 at the Battle of Midway, and another about a doomed raid by the 8th Air Force over Germany. And they were wonderful stories, and it was a privilege to write about those men. But I must say that this is the most extraordinary story about World War II that I was lucky enough, fortunate enough to be able to research and write on behalf of the family of Florence Finch and Colonel Englehart, Carl Englehart. Such a strong, independent, and indomitable person like Florence Finch was an inspiration to me. So I was glad to have the chance to write it.
The book is entitled The Indomitable Florence Finch, The Untold Story of a War Widow Turned Resistance Fighter and Savior of American POWs. And we've been joined today on the New Books Network with its author, Robert J. Mrazek. Thanks, Robert, so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Ian, it was a pleasure. Great to meet you, and Thank you so much.